Hello and welcome to Minor Rex. I'm Charlie, and today I'm here with Joel, Ariana, and Elizabeth as we talk about true crime. And that's a genre that's pretty self-explanatory, but it's a nonfiction genre that documents some of the most dark moments of human history. We won't be dwelling too long on the goriest details, but I guess suffice it to say, as a small advisory, if you don't have the stomach for talking about violent behavior, maybe listen to a different episode of this podcast. But if you love true crime, you are in the right place. We have talked about true crime a little bit in the past. In, I think, episode 48, we talked about the book I'll Be Gone in the Dark by Michelle McNamara. That has since been turned into a HBO miniseries, which I think a lot of us have been sort of watching as it came out when we were all locked at home. So what do we all think of the miniseries sort of in comparison and contrast to the book, if you've read it?
I have not read the book, so I don't necessarily have anything to kind of compare it to. But I was watching the series recently, kind of to prepare for this episode. I enjoyed it, but also found it very dark. So, like, I think if we were to discuss yesterday, I would have been, like, in a better mood. But I watched three episodes of it last night, and so I am very depressed right now.
Yeah, I think compared to the book, so I listened to the audiobook because I'm a big audiobook person. And I felt like compared to the book, it was, both of these things are very dark. And the version of the audiobook that I listened to was from after they found the killer. Spoil alert if you haven't watched the series. But they did, after the book was published, they did catch him. They added some afterwards and some details to a book, you know, the next publication of the book. And then also the series has a lot of details that they go into of how they managed to use Michelle McNamara's research as part of their evidence and managed to get this guy. And it's incredible to see. Unfortunately, of course, Michelle McNamara was not there to see it, but it's dark. And I think that's part of the really depressing part, is that she got into such a dark place that probably her predisposed issues, like with prescriptions and everything, kind of took her at quite a young age. And so she didn't get to stick around and see the fruits of her labor, basically, because she really researched this. I mean, this is some incredible work that she did on this book. And then you don't even realize, like, I think we know as librarians and just avid readers what goes into a book when it's being written, like nonfiction, but like, when you see a documentary like that and all of the footwork she did to write such an amazing book, you're just kind of taken aback, I feel like. When you hear about like the stacks and stacks of boxes that she went through of evidence, and you know, that was probably, some of it was probably a lot and some of it was probably like practically nothing, but she just sat and sifted through it, sometimes under the gun of like, you can have this for 12 hours or whatever, right? They would tell her, you know, just because she needed that information for her book. Mm-hmm. It's incredible to have that passion and that need to answer the questions.
Mm. One of the impressive things about the documentary, the book itself is fantastic. It's about the Golden State Killer. She actually coined the term the Golden State mm-hmm. Killer because he had some very not so clicky names, the Erons, right? The mm-hmm. East Area Rapist and the original Night Stalker. And then for decades later, just catching people up who aren't familiar with the book, I'll Be Gone in the Dark, this individual is never caught until within the last few years, possibly because of consistent interest in this book drummed up by Michelle McNamara. But the thing that I thought the documentary series did very well to inform is like the origin of her inquisitive nature and what caused that. The combination of the unsolved crime versus the need to solve the crime, those two would clash together and drive her forward and drive many people forward to investigate unsolved crimes. And that's possibly what drives a lot of true crime fans, is to possibly come up with their own idea of what happened and, you know, their own solution, or try to weigh what people think or not. But getting back to Michelle McNamara, one thing that impressed me was her relationship she built with everybody, with leading police authorities. This individual, the Golden State Killer, he had raped over 50 people, not to mention the murders later on in his quote-unquote career. But there were so many different jurisdictions at play, and she was able to investigate each one and make connections with a lot of different, you know, former police officers at that time, also with people who were on, you know, investigating it through online sleuthing and so forth. But she was able to make connections with these people, and they realized that she wasn't in it for the money, or, you know, she had an earnest interest to solve it, and she built a rapport. And she actually impressed a lot of people, and she got those boxes that you referred to, Elizabeth. It was just, she was able to show that she would be a good steward of these boxes.
Yeah.
Someone was able to get her a lot of the boxes that were in a back room, not being looked at for years and years and years. And of course, she was the one central point where she could take her knowledge of this case and move forward with that. And the other thing about that is, if she was in a very dark place, and the documentary does a great job of taking you into that dark place, we can just turn it off if it gets too dark. But she had to live in it because she had to deliver this book. And also does a great job of showing that, like, she felt the, the pressure of the deadline, but she had to finish it off. She had no alternative but to dwell in this place. And she, I think she did get an extension, but still, it was just so much and so much. And she was consistently trying to adjust her behavior through chemical, just combined in a very fatal way. And that was very sad.
Well, I think it's interesting, too, because not only is this book about the East Area Rapist or the Golden State Killer, or, you know, the original Night Stalker, whatever you want to call him, it's about her experience with that. So not only was she feeling the pressure of having to finish the book, but it was like she had to solve the crime, and she had to talk about her connection, like her relationship with this case in general. So it was like she had to then talk about herself and insert herself into this book, which made it very, like, one and very, like, where does her relationship and the case kind of end? And especially when she's trying to solve it and it's unsolved, and it's different than other, because I feel like a lot of people kind of insert themselves in true crime just because they're like, oh, like, you think about, oh, what would I do in this situation? Or, like, how did this affect me? But then you're not forced to produce something of that kind of nature.
Yeah.
And she was.
And the documentary also highlighted another layer on top of that was her husband's view of what was going on with her and her subject. So her husband, Patton Oswalt, was interviewed quite extensively, and other co-authors of the book that picked up with what she was writing later on. That was another layer on top of all of that. Plus, the documentary series delivered where the book could not. The book was fantastic, and I listened to an audiobook as well. But the interviews with the actual victims, to me, were just heartbreaking and courageous. And it was just very, I don't want to say remindful, is that a word? But it reminded me very much that these are actual people. They're not just statistics or, you know, names and dates. And I think that's another characteristic of true crime versus its cousin of mysteries, is that mysteries, you know, when you close the book, poof, they're gone. Like the character, even if it's Sherlock Holmes, it never existed.
Right.
Whereas true crime, these people did exist. They have, like, you know, consequences have gone on, and people know these people, and there's still, you know, there's a time and a date and a place and repercussions that have gone on. So watching these people come on screen and talk about their lives and what they remembered from the time that they were attacked and their lives now, I thought the documentary did a great job of tying that up.
And you get, some of them got to, like, meet each other. Like, they showed some of them meeting up, and that was kind of interesting. And I don't know if heartwarming would be the right term, but just, like, to see, like, the whole, like, I am not alone type of thing, that there's other people out there who have had, because, you know, when you have an experience like that, I think you feel like you're in a very singular place. I can't even imagine, but, like, that must be how you feel.
Yeah.
And to know that, unfortunately, there's other people who have had that very unique, horrendous experience, you know, because of the nature of these crimes, and to be able to connect with them, it could probably bring a whole different sense of healing than we could ever comprehend.
And empowerment.
Yeah.
One area of the documentary that I thought was really interesting, too, was how they interviewed some of the family members of the Golden State Killer. Mm-hmm. And the private citizen who was one of the investigators who worked with Michelle McNamara, she was saying, well, first, my heart goes out to the victims and the survivors, because obviously they went through all that trauma and what a thing to go through. But then she said, my heart also goes out to the family members of the people, because, you know, how can you live all this time with someone you don't even know that they were doing this? Or there was the killer's cousin was interviewed, and she was saying that she lived with him and she saw him as a father, and she just couldn't, like, believe this was going on, that he would do something of this nature. Hmm. I thought that was fascinating.
There was definitely a grieving process, very, not the same, but similar to the victims, but of just grieving for, you know, this was happening and I had no idea. Hmm. And there was also the nephew or someone, it was a male relative, mm-hmm. couldn't even speak at one point. It was just tearing up, and it just kind of felt for them to, how would you, basically you're up, a large part of your childhood was spent in the proximity of evil, and you didn't stop it.
Yeah.
How could you have known?
And yeah, I think that those human moments are just powerful on a visceral level that writing about them can't quite deliver that same gut punch. And I think that that's something that you can only really get in this documentary, as good as the book is. And, you know, we talked extensively about how much we enjoyed it. But yeah, there's just certain things that film can do that written word can't. Like just artistic stuff, like at one point the filmmakers bring in footage from the film Creature of the Black Lagoon, because they say that that was one of her favorite movies. I think it was the first movie that she and Patton saw together. And, you know, at first it's just like an illustration of a movie that she enjoyed. But as they keep using it throughout the episode, it becomes this sort of visual metaphor for the creature dragging poor Julie Adams into the briny depths. Mm-hmm. Is sort of like a metaphor for Michelle being pulled under by the weight of all of this terrible information that she has and has to sort of process and deliver to someone else. Yeah, they use that really effectively. And I mean, just visual scenes, like we mentioned the stacks of bankers' boxes on top of each other. Like, it's one thing to talk about all of the access that she had to some of this paperwork, but just seeing it, these heavy boxes in a room, it just kind of underlines the weight of it, yeah.
Even after she passed, they had a shot of the remaining boxes that were still there, the ungone through. So it kind of represented like the unfinished work, the work that was ahead of the co-authors.
Yeah. And it sort of functions as a making of the book. The book itself is, you know, for all extents and purposes, it's an unfinished work. It was finished posthumously by fellow internet sleuths and, you know, experts. But the book that she had in mind, it'll never exist. And so I think that the documentary gives really good perspective on that by bringing in the, like, archival footage of Michelle talking about the case and just being around and, you know, the interviews with the people that she did research with. Mm-hmm. And, you know, seeing other people who are fascinated by this case, it sort of acts as a mirror to us. Because, you know, we're all sort of in the same boat. We don't know what happened, but we're somehow compelled by how terrible it all is. Mm-hmm. So it shows if you are interested in this, there is a cost to, like, delving into the rabbit hole. Michelle's end being sort of like this warning. If you go too far, it might disturb you so much that you can't deal with it. And I think that that's sort of a danger that true crime makes you face, like, how much is too much? How disturbing is too disturbing?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I watched another documentary series on the Night Stalker. Hmm. The reason they call it the Golden State Killer, the original Night Stalker, was there was a Richard Ramirez was a Night Stalker in 1985, Los Angeles. And he would attack people in the same way at night and in their homes in the middle of the night while they're sleeping. And just very violent attacks. Some lived, some did not. It was just all over the place. The reason I'm bringing this up is that the documentary of the Night Stalker really portrays the stories of the police detectives behind the case. Mm-hmm. It also showed the cost of them finding the Night Stalker. And even when they were prosecuting the Night Stalker, what it was costing them and just the care that they were having for the victims, but also the personal wear and tear of their lives and how much they devoted to stopping this. It's not always the crime producers, it's the crime stoppers and the crime discoverers. to me, that's just almost as compelling in the true crime, and not only the act itself, but the discovery and the reporting of it, I guess.
In that nature, what do we think about, you know, all these citizen detectives and the sleuthing? Because I think, like you said, like what was interesting about that documentary that you saw on the Night Stalker was seeing the investigator's point of view. And I'm interested in what you guys think about how the internet has opened up to anyone kind of being an investigator. Or I can't like remember what happened, but I remember like Reddit came together to try to find a criminal or someone who did something, and they got it wrong. And it ruined this poor man's life. I ended up watching a documentary on Netflix called, like, I don't know if I'm able to swear, but it's called Don't F with Cats.
I think that's FCC available.
Okay. But that one, the internet banded together to try to track down this sadistic, well, he ended up being a serial killer, but at first he was, like, killing animals, and that's kind of why they're saying, you know, when you start effing with cats, that's when you just go too far, especially on the internet. But I just wonder, because we get to see kind of the background of people investigating, but not only do we get to see it, we get to be a part of that.
Yeah.
So what do you guys think about that new culture?
I think it's pretty fascinating just that so many people are able to band together and use the resources of the internet to try and find the answers to some mysteries. But as you alluded, sometimes they get it wrong, and sometimes they, you know, follow a red herring and end up ruining someone's lives. I think that might be a situation that's depicted in another Netflix documentary called Crime Scene, The Vanishing at the Cecil Hotel, which came out a couple of months ago, which is probably my least favorite true crime documentary of the last little while, because it does sort of illustrate the dangers of true crime sleuthing. And briefly, the case is a Canadian student named Eliza Lam is found missing in this sort of notoriously checkered hotel on Skid Row called the Cecil Hotel. And a security camera catches her last moments in an elevator acting very erratically. And when they put this online, it goes viral. People are like, what was she doing? What could have led to this extremely bizarre, you know, 3 minutes of footage? And so they go all in. They start tracking down every lead. They look for who else has stayed at the Cecil Hotel. She had a Tumblr, and she blogged pretty extensively about her personal life. And so they just went into every aspect that they could. And eventually they do find someone and start rattling his cage. And it turns out he has nothing to do with it. He was there a year before, but he posted his video a year late. And they said, oh, he posted a video from the Cecil Hotel at the same week, so it must be him. You know, I think it's kind of a tipping point, that documentary about the ethics of true crime, because, you know, first of all, it's too long. It's like 4 hours, 4-hour-long episodes, and it could have been, I think that's three too long. And the filmmakers do the thing that a lot of, like, miniserieses do, where a lot of the information they'll withhold until the next episode to keep you watching, but it means that they waste so much time with these people following up on this poor musician who writes songs about dark stuff, but he's not a murderer. It kind of points out the irresponsibility of some of this, like, vigilante researching by private citizens.
So, like, I think it's like anything with the internet where, you know, more power to the people that want to kind of do their own thing and maybe dig into things. But hey, let's avoid victim blaming, number one, because like when you're looking at true crime, you're also a lot of the time you're possibly looking at rape and murder. And, you know, when you're looking at that and you start victim blaming, you're really stepping in some doo-doo. These people have families. The victims have families. The criminals have families. And the people who you might blame that didn't do it have families, and they are people with lives, and they have, you know, livelihoods and jobs. And so you can't just go and ruin their life just because, you know, you think they came out of the gas station at the time that you think they came out of the gas station. And that's when this happened. And so while I respect the fact that people in the back of their mind are like, I'm going to help, they are not necessarily a trained investigator. It's just like anything else with the internet. You're not a doctor. I don't want you stitching up my leg or whatever. You know, like, that's wonderful. You looked into it. You have a theory. Good for you. Don't set fire to it because you don't know.
Yeah. I mean, you don't need credentials to start a YouTube account.
Right. I get it. Like, I see you have Stay Sexy and Don't Get Murdered. I get that there's a whole culture of murderinos and like they're all, and that's wonderful. I've read that book and there's a wonderful podcast and like, it's great. I get that. I'm interested in true crime. I love the idea that live like communities and citizens banding together to be vigilant and talk about these things. But it's not because I think that it's got to be done by the authorities, so to speak, but it needs to be done thoroughly and properly before you start accusing someone. Because once that accusation is out there, no matter how it is made or who it's made by, it's been made. And if it's on the internet, it's never going away. Like, I think that that's part of what I think of it. Like, yeah. I love that people are curious and that they want to help. But I'm also very nervous about people being curious and wanting to help.
Right.
I think the internet kind of amplifies who you are, you know, like your intentions. If you're responsible and you're, you know, treat others with respect, that'll come through on the internet. You want to help. Or if other people are just find it entertaining and don't respect other people, they're going to come out with that. So yeah. I actually read a book called Gone at Midnight, The Mysterious Death of Elisa Lam by Jake Anderson. And he does a great job in talking about the web sleuth community and also its relationship to the police detectives. Because some people would figure out something on the web and they'd contact the police and the police would be like, okay, whatever. And he is espousing, I mean, he himself is a web sleuth, but he's wanting them to really focus and make their impact more in a focused nature where they can provide the police with documentary evidence, with backup, and not sound so crazy.
Yeah.
That was like one of the huge things about the Elisa Lam case that he investigated in his own way. He also took the mental health approach where she was struggling with some mental health issues. And he was actually diagnosed with bipolar disorder while writing the book. So he reveals a lot of that in the book as well, to possibly illuminate what was going on with her struggles at the end of her life. And just the whole mystery, he also brings in the Cecil Hotel staff. He also mentions the police cover-up, possible LAPD cover-up. And again, going back to the unknown nature of things, which is the draw, I think, of this genre, but sometimes there are too many questions. It was a book written in earnest, and it was very well done, but I think it diffused a lot into different characteristics. But I think that with the internet, the advent of the internet, and he also had the question of why was that specific footage released and not any other footage from any other security cameras that were throughout the entire hotel.
Right.
And I think that was behind his, because I think the police released that video.
Right.
And he's like, why only that video? And they were trying to skew public opinion of this is how she was acting in this strange and this crazy video, whereas other videos might not have illuminated that. So,
Speculation about the video, they go into that. That's one of the rabbit holes they fall into in the Netflix. Like, was it doctored? Are there missing bits of it? And it just all seems like speculative stuff, that a lot of which is debunked. And I think that by giving some of those voices a lot of screen time, it sort of legitimizes them in a way that shouldn't be. Yeah, I'd be interested in reading the book because it sounds like it gives a little bit more perspective and nuance to it.
It was also one person's journey.
Right.
Into, again, like McNamara, it was his discovery of the facts and the process and how he got involved in it and, you know, his own life during that time. And he actually went into a dark place as well. And I think, Elizabeth, you mentioned at one point where you enjoy watching true crime, reading or watching, but then you have to stop. You know, there's a point where, you know, if you're watching and reading this stuff, you just get to a point where like, man, I just give me good comedy or something. Looking into the abyss of human nature is just,
people are scary and it's dark outside.
Yeah. Going back to the Night Stalker and the Golden State, like a lot of their attacks are at night. And I'm watching this stuff maybe at midnight, 1 o'clock, and I'm turn off the TV and close up shop and go upstairs. I'm like, I am now entering the prime time when this could, something could happen to me.
Yeah.
And I've actually had a home invasion and it was not a very fun experience. And so it's mildly, I would say mildly triggering, but you get through it, but it's just, you get to a point where it stops. I mean, you have to stop.
That's terrifying that you actually had one. I had like a scare before, and I don't know if it's because I'm obsessed with stuff like this and I'm like very interested in stuff like this. So I don't know if like naturally, like you said, like you're watching it at midnight or, you know, you hear a sound and it's like dark outside and you think, oh my God, like this is happening or what would you do? But like, I remember like when I was living with my sister, we had like in Lakeview, like our house, we had this like old door and you had to like slam it a bunch of times to close it. And I remember sleeping and then hearing it slam over and over again. I thought someone was coming in. So I just start screaming my sister's name to like get her up so we can like run out of the house. And it ended up just being her slamming the door. And she started like yelling at me because she was like, what are you doing? Like, why are you screaming my name? Like, why are you holding a broom? Like, it was just like all these different things. But it's like, I think when you read this stuff and when you watch this stuff, it very well could happen, but you're more inclined to think that it will.
But it's that knowledge that it can that probably is kind of like an evolutionary thing for us. We all know it can. As we get older, we're aware. But like, if we're into reading about it or watching stuff on it, you just, you know more. You probably know grosser things and like, you know, scarier things about it. But like, when you're young, you're like, no way, it won't happen to me, you know? And then you start to get a little older and maybe you've read some of the scarier stuff and you start to think, ooh, it could happen. It's happened to people my age. And I think that that's also, you know, because really you don't go into read true crime to have that moment of like, ooh, someone like me has had, you know, maybe you do, I don't know. But, you know, I think that there's something about hearing that this has happened and then carrying that with you when you go to lock all the doors at night, it's in the back of your mind, even if it's been, you know, 3 years since you read about something that happened.
Well, that's the thing about true crime. It has a lot of relatives in a lot of other genres. I mentioned before the mystery, people who like historical fiction or just pure history, they might enjoy true crime because there's a ton of historical detail. I remember just between the last few decades of my life, or ever since I was 18, even before, I would read a lot about Jack the Ripper. And like, it would just fascinate me that no one's been able to figure out. It's like the most talked about criminal possibly of all time, maybe besides Kane. You know, even to the point where I'd be able to, oh, that's another Rumbelow book. Oh, what does Wilson have to say this time? You know, and you get to know all the authors. So the historical detail and the mystery, but then there's also the horror thrill. And it's almost like putting yourself into the final girl mode. And what would you do? Sometimes that really hits close to home, and that's what really freaks you out.
So it gets the adrenaline pumping.
You know, it makes you, if there's a shadow moving in the backyard, you're like, whoa, what was that? But then if you're like, okay, that's it. You know, 2 months later, you're, oh, wait, this true crime looks great. Let's watch this. Let's do this one.
You never learn. You never learn.
So it's all cyclical. It's just so fun to, I read a book called Man from the Train by Bill James, who's actually a baseball writer. And I remember Very Lonely Nights. It's about a man who kills entire families at night while they're sleeping with an axe, with a blunt side of an axe, 100+ years ago. And he was able to find a few murders, and then he found a few more, and then he found a few more. And these murders also include the famous axe murders in Villisca, Iowa in 1912. But he ended up writing a book about, he was saying, these murders didn't just happen in 1911, 1912. They happened not only from 1908 to 1912. They are a span from 1901 to 1912, this individual. And he has all these, you know, characteristics that links all these crimes together. Very fascinating. Listen to an audiobook. But I remember long drives going home at night and just being in a very desolate landscape and listening to this book and looking over my shoulder into the back seat. And I also do like horror movies. So that's the correlation, I think, there. I think that's only in this case, to me, it's more visceral because it actually happened.
And see, that sounds fascinating to me because something with that much of a history would be really fascinating to research, to figure out, because they didn't have the forensics then that they do now. So looking back Could you imagine trying to find your way through that paperwork and through that, like trying to figure out where the records are? And because there's also nobody who put those records to paper. Right. You have to figure it. That's your own pathway you have to figure out.
And that's the thing. The Man from the Train by Bill James and Rachel McCarthy James. They explain all the facts in Secession. There's the handprints left on the axe. This is before fingerprints. But then after newspaper accounts come out of the handprints on the axe, now then they find further later events have the axe washed off. And he would always take the axe that was at the house and use it. So not to give too many details, but I'm just saying is that a common occurrence for unsolved mysteries is skeptical ignorance and like rivalries between jurisdictions. I'm going to solve this. We're going to solve this. And there's no connection. And that's what was successful in I'll Be Gone in the Dark was McNamara was able to unite all of these investigations and put them all into the same row, the same with The Man from the Train, where they were able to look at all these newspaper accounts and look at all the similarities. And that's what fascinated me. Like, wait a second. There was a serial murderer in the first decade of the 20th century that murdered over 100 people. And then the crime stopped, not because he stopped, but he moved to a different continent. And there's more. So I encourage, if this sounds interesting, it's actually a really good book. And the authors really have an approachable attitude of, and this is the case of many true crime books where they know who their audience is. Very conversational. It's not clinical. It's very accessible. And I think I enjoy that in this book and in others. And Michelle McNamara did a great job of it as well, of just treating the listener as if they were like sitting across the table from them and along for the ride.
I mean, it's definitely its own genre, and it has a formula almost to it in the same way that a mystery book or a romance book has a formula. It's engage the reader almost in like a storytelling kind of way, but then also bring them in as they're still part of it and they're trying to figure it out. I'm not surprised in the way that it is almost like a story. And I'm also not – I love the historic. So I can see why historical fiction fans or history nonfiction readers would be pulled – into this kind of thing, because so many of the crimes, like without the forensic evidence, it tells you about the times. Like even with I'll Be Gone in the Dark, oftentimes like the cops didn't pursue it, or they were kind of like you said, like the victim blaming, or a lot of times they asked the husband, why didn't you do anything? And that's a very like 70s type of mind view.
And it turns out there was such a threat in that situation. And when you read about, like you said, like when you read about that time period, like Summer of Sam and all the stuff that happened back in those decades, when there was that kind of like a very, I don't want to use the word chauvinistic attitude, but like what you see from like the research into I'll Be Gone in the Dark, they would say to the husbands, or like, but then you see like other women who had crimes against them from that time period. And a lot of it was like, why didn't a man save you? And you think, well, because either there wasn't one around or
there was nothing.
That was not a possibility. Or like the victim blaming, just basically like, what did you do wrong that you were the attacked person?
I thought there's two great points where one, they included the husband in one of the victim profiles, so to speak. I thought that was great. They gave every scene, almost every scene of that one. He was in the scenes with her every single time. And it helped track and showed their relationship and how it affected their relationship. And how it became a characteristic of their relationship. The fact that they were both attacked together and how he felt helpless and he couldn't help her. How she was understanding of that, of his inaction at that time. And also the inclusion of a female police officer, I was very surprised to learn. And that she stayed so involved in the case. She was appearing in the show 4 decades later. And I thought that was fantastic.
Was marvelous, yeah.
She was there to just kind of be there right after the moment, to be with them as a woman in that moment. And I thought, how many police departments had that capability in the mid-70s in California?
And what a difference that probably made at the time and makes now when you look at that, when you think about how she may have handled dealing with the victims and talking to them and the crime scene, just knowing how a woman might have reacted. And then like when they were looking at the crime scene in the immediate moment, because you do have different reactions depending on if you're home alone or if you're, and women and men have different mindsets in those moments. I believe they do. Everybody's different. But I know when I'm home by myself, I act differently than my husband does when he's home by himself. You know, like, it's just what happens. But like, back then, it was probably the same where, like, when a woman's home by herself, like, if you come in the house, every door gets locked immediately. Mm. Ariana's nodding her head, and you're like, you know, you're turning on all the light switches, checking all the rooms like a weirdo behind all the doors. And some days you're more doing that than others. But I could imagine if you had that amplified sense of fear, because you must have, whether or not you knew you were going to get attacked, there's something in you, even just like a little like hair on your back of your neck type of thing. And then that creepy, murderous jerk comes in and assaults you. And I can only imagine what those crime scenes were like. And so a woman investigator coming in would have made a lot of difference handling that crime scene and kind of just being like, okay, what would a woman do when she came in or when she was in her house? Because this guy, if you're listening to this and you haven't read the book or watched the documentary, this guy was all kinds of like stalkery, creepy, like watching them hiding in yards and
ligatures already hidden under seat cushions, couch cushions. Ugh.
Yeah, definitely premeditated.
Been in there before.
So if you didn't have the hair on the back of your neck standing up, I can't imagine. Like, if you were surprised, that would be even worse. It would be bad either way. But so anyway, I'm rambling a little bit, but what I'm saying is a woman investigator would have made all the difference. And like you said, Joel, at that time, it's phenomenal that she was there.
Yeah.
And is still, you know, wants to come out and talk about it.
That was a very shining moment of the miniseries for me.
Yeah.
Has anyone seen the most recent episode? In 2020, the main 8 episodes came out, but was it last month? They put out a sequel episode that covers the trial.
Mm. Yeah.
Oh, I did not watch that.
Yeah, I did see that one.
I thought it was okay.
Yeah.
I thought it was a little underwhelming after, you know, how much of a piece the first season, I guess, was. It didn't compel me in the same way.
I could definitely see that they viewed it as necessary to close that up.
Right.
To show the trial and the conviction of the perpetrator and to illuminate just the fact that he may be an old man, but age does not excuse.
Like,
they also highlighted the fact that he presented himself in a way that he was not.
Mm-hmm.
Even in the courtroom, he was a doddering old man, but they showed footage of him in his cell that showed he was not, in fact, that. And so it really,
his calisthenics and
it highlighted the cunning nature of this individual.
Right. I think that those were the scenes that stuck with me most, but for the most part, I was kind of expecting some catharsis of justice being served. And I didn't really get, there wasn't that payoff. It seemed like it existed just because people wanted it to exist, but it didn't really justify its existence. I don't know.
Yeah, I think I have a more positive outlook on things than you do, Charlie, maybe. But any true crime worth its salt is not, I mean, how fun is it to have a nicely wrapped up mystery? You know, like, so there's got to be an element of doubt or, you know, or did they?
Yeah.
Kind of thing. And in my personal opinion.
Yeah, maybe you're right. Maybe I am cynical because I had the same thought about the second season of Making a Murderer, where I thought the first season was just so well paced. It sucked you into the story. And then I watched the second season and I might as well have not watched it because I don't remember a darn thing about it.
Hmm.
Yeah, it just seemed like it existed because so many people enjoyed is a weird word because, I don't know, that is sort of a corollary to this ethical question of, are we making it entertainment too much?
Yeah.
That's my issue with the genre. And I mean, kind of like how you said, like where, or you were disappointed by the one documentary you watched or even like where it's like, I'm conflicted about it because it's good that it's out there, but are we consuming it for our own, like the fact that, like, does it have to end on an unsolved note? Mm-hmm. Like, the formula it follows, because I've watched parodies of true crime. So, like, I watched American Vandal on Netflix, and that's where it follows a high schooler who ends up vandalizing his school by drawing phallic images on like cars and the parking lot. And so it's his journey and one of the other kids with his help, he's the investigator, trying to prove his innocence. And it's interesting because they have the tone of these documentaries or the podcast we might listen to where it has the same kind of true crime music. It has like that tone. And then it's like, there was like one difference with the drawing that kind of proved that he may have not done it. And they're like, oh my God, you're right. And it was just like, it was like very much, it followed a formula. It followed what we love and consume. So, and I mean, I ate it up and I thought it was hysterical, but then I'm so conflicted where it's like, should I be doing this? Even with listening to My Favorite Murder, which is a podcast from the women who wrote the book Stay Sexy and Don't Get Murdered, which they wrote because of the popularity of My Favorite Murder, where these two women talk about all these different murders and about like their fascination with it. And they're comedians, so they make it funny, but then I wonder, are we viewing it lightly? Are we not taking it seriously? And are we making it something that it shouldn't be?
Yeah, like there's a sense of, I don't want to say voyeurism, but some sort of entertainment of looking into someone else's life.
Yeah.
And kind of like what you were referencing before of it not happening to me.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
I think maybe one possible solution to that ethical question is when the media itself is made by someone who is affected by the crime. On HBO, I think it was last year, there's this really great docuseries called Murder on Middle Beach. Has anyone seen that one? I highly recommend it. It's directed by a young filmmaker named Madison Hamburg, whose mother was mysteriously killed when he was a teenager. And so as a budding documentary filmmaker, he looks into his own past and present and goes to his family, most of whom are like, you know, we love you, Madison. I'll do anything. And then he gets them on camera and says, did you murder my mom? And that's uncomfortable,
wow.
But they want to help in any way they can. So they tell him what she was like. And he learns a lot that he would not have known as her son about her alcoholism. And she had an involvement in this gifting table scheme, which is sort of like a multi-level marketing type pyramid scheme of dubious legality. You know, most of his family members are very forthcoming, except for his father, who is very, very evasive. And the most ethically dubious parts of that are when he meets up with his dad and, you know, has hidden cameras and hidden microphones on him. It's definitely a heart-pumping moment because, you know, he's nervous. I'm sure his dad is suspicious that he's being taped but doesn't really let on. Madison himself is very visibly concerned about the ethics of the situation. And so that sort of centers it in a way that it's just kind of the subtext of a lot of other true crime. So yeah, I think that it's got the mystery, it's got the murder, but it's also a personal sort of autobiographical story, you know, that takes away the aspect of, you know, are we being disrespectful to the memory of a victim or are we turning someone's personal tragedy into entertainment? So yeah, that's definitely recommended if you have HBO or HBO Max. And there's also a similar documentary that's on Canopy called Dear Zachary, A Letter to a Son About His Father. It's just a movie, so it's not as long-term a commitment as a miniseries, but that's also a very compelling, very tragic story of family.
Yeah, that adds another level onto, you know, when you're telling from a centered perspective. I do think that there is especially with knowing so much about Jack the Ripper, there is a book out called The Five.
Oh, I read it. I highly recommend it.
Yeah.
Listen to it on audiobook.
Okay. And, which is on Hoopla, actually, right?
Yeah. I listen to it on Libby.
Okay. So
I don't know
Libby.
If it's on Hoopla right now, but I listen to it through Libby.
Can you talk more about it? Because I haven't read it, but I want to. It centers more of the people behind the mysteries, not the killer himself, who obviously should not get the women behind.
Yeah, I actually pulled it up right here on my phone because I meant to bring it up earlier when you were talking about just the historical nature of the Night Stalker. But The Five, The Untold Lives of the Women Killed by Jack the Ripper is by Hallie Rubenhold. And it actually doesn't really talk about Jack the Ripper at all. It talks about these five women who were all killed. And it talks about the nature of Jack the Ripper in the sense that they didn't investigate these murders to the extent, and they didn't empathize these women because they were all seen as prostitutes. But that's not necessarily true. I think only one of them was actually a prostitute. The other for had like prosperous lives because of circumstance. It was more about the historical elements of that time. So it talked about like what brought the women to the point where they were, because most of them were homeless when they did get killed by Jack the Ripper, but a lot of them had kids or were married. Like one of them lived in a Victorian home and had horses, and a lot of them were addicted to alcohol, but it was once again their circumstances that drove them there. So it's more a piece about the society at the time and what pushed them to the point of where they were when they were murdered. But it empathizes with these women and sees, like, has you see them in a light of them actually being human, opposed to, oh yeah, Jack the Ripper just killed 5 prostitutes. But it's a fantastic book. The audiobook's really good. It is long, but it's just packed with so much factual information. And it's just really well told, and you find out a lot of things about these women that you didn't know.
That sounds really good. I'm going to have to put it on my TBR.
It's available right now on Libby.
Well, I'm in the middle of other things right now, Joel.
Yeah, I have another recommendation for a book. So it's not nonfiction, but it's a YA novel called Sadie. I don't know if
anybody
read it. Oh,
Sadie is so good. And that's a good audio. Mm-hmm. Did you do the audio too?
Oh, yeah. That's how I listened to it.
Yeah, because I actually recommend the audio over the print, because the audio is done as like a podcast mixed with just read as like a regular book. And the podcast element is done as like a podcast of the guy like investigating what happened to these sisters. It's just a really interesting take on the genre of suspense thriller whodunit type of YA. Some YA books are interesting because they're almost more adult than you expect them to be. Like, and that's one of them where you listen or you read it and you go, whoa, that was an intense read, because I really think that teen reads can be so grown up. They can make you think so hard sometimes. And it's, yeah, that is one I also recommend.
And it's Sadie by Courtney Summers.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. And it's not super long. So
no.
That's one where if you're looking for something that you can listen to in kind of like a 5-day period of your work week commute, you'll probably get through it.
Yeah, and the audio is read like a podcast, a serial-type podcast. So You have Sadie's side of the story while she's trying to track down a murderer, and then you have the podcast, which is then trying to track down Sadie. And it's done like serial.
And not based on a true story, but still in the same, like using true crime vernacular.
Yeah, it feels very true crime while you're listening to it. Yeah.
So that also always brings up an interesting standpoint, where I'm framing this of lovers of mystery books. And people who read mystery books, there's always a body. It has to be a body.
Yeah.
If you read a mystery about a stolen artwork, maybe not so intense. You know, and I wondered, why does there have to be a body to make it a good story?
Right. Because, yeah, there are crimes other than murder.
Right.
But it seems a lot of true crime just centers around murder. And there are definitely exceptions. I mean, Tiger King was a huge thing last year, and I think you could view that from a true crime perspective.
Yeah,
don't forget Joe Exotic is still in jail for a murder for hire plot. One true crime thing that I really enjoyed recently that isn't at all, like nobody dies, or no one's murdered, I should say, is McMillions. Have you seen this one? I think this is on HBO as well.
Is that the McDonald's story?
Yeah, it's about in the 90s. There were no legitimate winners of the McDonald's Monopoly game. And because the stakes are kind of lower than, you know, it's not a life or death thing. It's just massive, massive fraud of a multi-billion dollar corporation. Everyone who is involved is only too happy to tell their side of the story. It's very interesting and very compelling, but it's something that isn't going to...
That's so believable, too, because as somebody who was old enough in the 90s to remember that, I'm sure you agree, Joel. Nobody won that, ever. You'd peel that thing off your drink and you'd get, like, free fries or something.
Right, that's all it was. And or it was, like, New York Avenue all the time.
Yeah.
You know, Connecticut Avenue.
Get your free apple pie.
Meanwhile, they find out that 3 people with the same last name won the $1 million prize in New Jersey. And
yeah.
I'm like, that's... interesting. So eventually the FBI does get involved and starts asking people to talk. And of course, they don't have their stories straight. And things start unraveling pretty quickly after that. But I would recommend that. If you're interested in true crime, but you're maybe not ready for something that's going to take you down to the very depths of humanity.
I did bring a kid's book I found in the J section of the nonfiction called Duped, True Stories of the World's Best Swindlers. Mm. So that is something to think of when you think of true crime. There is like the swindling end of things. I didn't go too hard looking into this, but I thought it was interesting because it does have some black and white illustrations and short kind of stories. So for fact-loving kiddos or your fact-loving self, it's Duped, and the author is Andrea Schroeder. I thought that was an interesting one, but since you brought up that there's not always a body, I thought that was an appropriate time to bring that up. And there were some other books in the section with like stories similar to this, because for kids, true crime cannot always be scary murder. It's right. Got to be some other stuff. But they still like sometimes ask about like, do you have stories about criminals? And you're like,
do we ever?
Yeah, do we ever? Let's see what we can find. There were some other ones that came up when I did a search, but this was the one that popped out at me when I walked over to the shelf. So,
but there's devastation, right? I mean, because
you know, I think there's probably some big money that got stolen. There's probably some big lies told that brought some stuff down. You know what I saw over there when I went that I didn't grab? I thought about it, but there was also, these were right next to like a kind of thick looking book that said pirates on the side. And I thought that's something we don't think about, but pirates.
True crime.
Pirate stories for kids, kind of like one of the introductions of true crime that they would get, because that
I used to love, and still kind of do, pirates.
Yeah.
And just the adventure and like the names of some of the, I think Blackbeard's ship was Queen Anne's Revenge.
At some point you might start to learn, if you have an interest in it, the fairy tale pirates start to morph into the what truly is
what
a pirate does. Mm-hmm. And that becomes kind of what you know about kind of a true crime character, so to speak. Like, you know, kind of pirates, gangsters, that type of thing are almost bigger than life, but they are real.
Yeah. So I used to be a big fan of pirates, and then I considered what would I feel like if I was on ship being boarded by pirates. You know, I'm like, maybe not so awesome.
You'd probably wet your pants, Joel.
Right? Or get dunked into the wet,
Just
go swim with the sharks.
You'd just be like, I'll just be over here, sploosh, and then you'd just be gone.
Or they would throw me over.
Yeah, you know? Either or.
Speaking of swindling, and kind of maybe circling back to killing, but I think we would be remiss in a true crime podcast and not mentioning a story that happened close by. If you talk to almost anyone about true crime, what's the one book that they will come out with but Devil in the White City Eric Larson, right?
Yeah.
Some of the artistic license, maybe? The imagined conversations that may or may not have happened.
Yeah. His prose is very purple.
Yeah.
And I think that took me away from the believability of it, I think.
Right. So it's an interesting book. But I would like to counter that with another book about the same topic called H.H. Holmes, A True History of the White City Devil by Adam Seltzer. I remember reading this book, and he has a few things to say about a certain other book of the same topic, and it cracked me up a lot. And it's pretty long, and to me it seemed, I was listening to it on audiobook, and it may not have been as engaging as Sadie or The Five. It felt a little dusty at some points, but the reason it felt dusty was it's just a ton of information. Mm. Very well researched. I was very surprised at how much it differed from The Devil in the White City, from his research. So I would encourage anyone who's read Devil in the White City, if you want to go back and revisit that topic of H.H. Holmes and his murder castle, I would definitely recommend this book by Adam Seltzer, the H.H. Holmes, The True History of the White City Devil.
And yeah, that sort of points to how different accounts of the same basic events can be and how much maybe editorializing or just different perspectives that different authors can have when, you know, using the same source material.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because even when it comes down to it, everybody's got their own like writing style and research style. So
and reason that they're compelled by the topic.
Yeah, and that's why when you look at like certain books, you'll be like, wow, this one really, you know, shone this light on this person in this direction, and this one really made this person look this way, you know. Then you have to go and figure out yourself if this person was a, you know, who was the real messed up one in the situation and all
when that comes back to the advent of the internet, you know,
right.
And that just really just poured gasoline onto this fanned flame of difference and perspective and shading. And
Well,
I guess they say too, if you're reading or if you're looking into cold case files, you shouldn't read it in order, because you should, like, there's a show, I think it's on HBO, I forget what streaming thing it's on, but it's called The Imposter. It follows like a cold case about a murderer, but the person who puts it out wants you, like, you don't have to watch the series in succession. Because when you're reading something with a bunch of different information, the narrator changes your mind about how you feel about it. It's like, oh, well, maybe I don't feel this way, or what should I do? But it's, you should be able to just look at the facts and read the files out of order to try to create your own opinion.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I guess it's all about connecting the dots, trying to find order where there is chaos. You know, that's what maybe all true crime authors have in common, that this sort of need to collate information and make sense of it, even when it's a senseless act that they're investigating.
And it's up to you as the reader to not just download that verbatim. And I think that's a great characteristic of true crime, is that the fertile ground for original thought, I guess, you know, going back to my Jack the Ripper research, where someone would say something and I'd be like, oh, I don't believe that at all. And like, where did he get that from? You know, and it just, I remember having that disagreement. And then also the fulfillment when someone wrote something that I agreed with. I'm like, yes, that makes absolute sense. And so it allows you to kind of take ownership of, you know, not to be voyeuristic about it, but to just to try to figure out what exactly happened and why does that matter so much. I've been looking at that in my head, like, why does it matter that? Because I think I wanted to put a face to it to help rationalize it. And that's why I'll Be Gone in the Dark was very effective, because there was a point when the Golden State Killer was unknown. And then there's a point the Golden State Killer is known. And there's a huge and dramatic difference between those two experiences. At least with the known, it changes your perspective of the crimes versus, you know, if there was unknown and that person would still be out there and just never having been caught. And
what's closure in a lot of ways? It's not as exciting maybe because there's an end, but it is kind of like you can give a sigh of relief because you can put that face there and you're no longer in danger of being raped or murdered by the East Area Rapist or the original Night Stalker or the Golden State Killer, whatever you want to call it. But it's just, I mean, kind of like Charlie said, like anticlimactic, but at the same time necessary, and we all need that closure. Just causes you to not feel the adrenaline rush anymore.
Going back to the non-original Night Stalker, the second Night Stalker in L.A., in that documentary was effective at the end because they figured out who he was and they put his picture on the front page of the paper. They understood he would use the bus station, so they had police coverage at the bus station to stop him from leaving. He was actually, that day, he was already out of town in Arizona at his brother's place and coming back into town to the bus station. So they were watching all the entrances and he came out the exit and went to a neighboring store to buy alcohol or something, and he saw his picture on the paper. And then he also saw the clerk maybe kind of put together the fact that he was there and the paper. So he quickly got on a bus and someone else on the bus recognized him in the paper. This is all going somewhere. So the person got off the bus soon after that, called the police, and as he's calling the police from a payphone, he told the truck driver, follow that bus. The Night Stalker is on that bus. And Richard Ramirez saw this happening. He gets off. He starts running through the neighborhoods of L.A. And people are slowly realizing that this person running is the Night Stalker. Mm. People are coming out of their houses with weapons. He was actually hit in the head with a tire iron. And he's actually so afraid of the community, and he keeps running through all these neighborhoods. He finally stops, sees a police officer in the distance, and sits down on the curb and waits for the sheriff to come up and arrest him because he's so afraid of the community that he has terrorized this whole summer of 1985, I believe. I thought that was very interesting of how he was caught. You know, how the people just got so tired and fed up with not knowing who the Night Stalker was, and just like his cast of fear over everybody, and his control vanished and people took charge.
And that's when the media works well.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like we were talking about the internet before and how it can get out of control. Mm-hmm. But when you think about 1985, they pretty much had the newspaper, they had TV news, and they had the radio. And so that newspaper, people seeing it probably across a pretty wide swath of the country, mm-hmm. and then hearing on the radio or seeing it on the local news, and then they were able to be like, okay, this is what's happening. And then in the neighborhood, of course, you've got the phone tree that is, at that time, neighbors actually talk to each other. I'm sure it was, like you said, Joel, that had to be quite the thing to, you know, like when you process what went down there to the point where, when you think about how fed up you can get just being stuck inside during a stay-at-home order. So, like, something that terrible as a mass murderer going around like that, add that to not knowing and not knowing what's happening to your neighbor and your family and all that. And then, everybody working together to just be like, get out your tire iron and stand in the front yard, man, that guy's running around. Mm-hmm. That's tremendous.
Well, I can't believe anyone murders still in today's day and age. I mean, just the anxiety you must feel as a murderer, but I mean, also just with everyone being so connected and the media working in more beneficial ways.
Right.
Like, why even put yourself through that? Like,
well, most people don't commit murder out of reasoned calculation, right? It's
They're not thinking rationally, Ariana.
But maybe it is a deterrent to not have a Reddit community named after you.
Yeah. Right. So if you suspect, maybe you should just start naming Reddit communities after people. Not really in mean ways, but just, you know.
Oh, just in helpful ways.
Just in helpful ways.
Well, and also the nature of murder, to be perfectly serious, has changed nowadays.
That's true.
You know, it's more of a mass shooting rather than a serial killer done in secret, so to speak.
That is true.
Yeah.
You know, it goes with serious issues with decision-making and dealing with different emotions, but it's morphed, I guess. Maybe because of that reason.
Yeah, there's a lot of layers to that.
You know, maybe they want the fame that the internet can bring in that moment. They want that name broadcast out, so.
The infamy that comes with it.
It's
more about the infamy, like, it's like they want to get caught.
Mm-hmm. So I was actually up in the fourth floor true crime section earlier today, and there's honestly a row of books about 15 to 20 feet long up there, all in the 364.1532 or thereabouts area. So highly encourage people to come up. Even if you're not a fan of true crime per se, just come up and take a look and just see if something catches your interest, because they have modern day vampire stories. They have, you know, gangsters. There's a great book called Public Enemies by Brian Burroughs, America's Greatest Crime Wave and the Birth of the FBI in the 1930s. It talks about Machine Gun Kelly and Bonnie and Clyde and John Dillinger. I learned what a Kansas City typewriter was in that book, which of course is a machine gun. To me, I think it's amazing because it connects so inherently into real life, and yet it's so flexible, and you can find something in it that interests almost anyone.
Yeah. Yeah, we do have so much true crime here at the library. As you mentioned, the 364s are the place to go, and that can either be on the fourth floor or on the second floor.
Yes.
In the J364s for junior criminologists.
Yeah, we do have some true crime books with chilling accounts of evil in our time. In the middle school section, we have a really good one on the Borden murders. It is called The Borden Murders, Lizzie Borden and the Trial of the Century by Sarah Miller that came out a few years ago. That's so if you have a little murderino in your family, a middle school murderino or high school murderino in your family that would like to look at one of the most infamous murder investigations and trials, that's definitely a chiller. So
yeah, I've heard good things about the Borden murders.
Yeah, that's
the book,
not
the murders themselves.
No, yeah, because you've heard some wacky things about the Borden murders.
40 whacks, right? Pun intended. Anyway, sorry. And of course, in our DVD section, we've got all the documentaries. If you don't have Netflix, we have Rokus. So you can check out a Roku, watch some of that. It's on Hoopla. It's on Canopy. Basically, anything that we have at the library, you can find some true crime there.
Yeah, you can sort it into any of those things that Charlie just mentioned and do a sort file, and you'll find true crime is one of the genres you can sort through. So.
And you could probably find a librarian or someone at a desk who could talk it up a little, too. Mm-hmm. So if you need a recommendation, we're happy to help. Although if you come to the second floor and ask me about true crime, I am going to take you to the children's section.
Well, thank you for listening. This has been Minor Rex, and we will see you next time.